I read Amargan's song, which is the poem that the druid Amargan spoke when he stepped foot on Ireland. But every sentence is, I am something, like I am the wind on the sea, I'm a hawk on a cliff, I'm a lake in the plain. So it really spoke to this idea of the druid or the animistic practitioner as a shapeshifter or someone whose identity is not fully fixed. So I thought it was a good poem for transformation. And it's also the only thing that I have that I think might have been a prayer before Christianity. So it's become this really important. It's been a recurring piece in my work because it's the only thing that I can find that it feels like a prayer that maybe got turned into a poem as time went on.
Welcome to Not Work, Myth and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Before we explore this week's story, I have a question for you. What about your stories? Whether it's a book project that wants to be birthed, deep, authentic writing to support your business, or a personal creative project you can't quite name yet, I'm here to support you through the entire writing process, from the initial ideation stage to the crafting of narrative and beyond. If you're ready to write memoir or a chronicle of the spiritual journey or a book that explores healing, nature, and the power of imagination, as well as the toughest truths of today, call on me. I walk beside you as you uncover the story that only you can tell. I'm a confidant who supports you through the challenges, and I'm your champion who will offer the nudges you need to get the words on the page. And yes, we hold space for the mythical and the magical all along the way. Visit my website, marisagowdy.com, to learn more about my writing coaching services and set up a free 30-minute consultation. Season 6, Episode 15, A Mythic Journey Through Wicklow and Kildare with Ronan O'Rahilly. As part of our Myth Workers and Culture Makers series, Ronan joins us for what is essentially a mythic travelogue of the places he knows so well in Wicklow and Kildare. Following his collection of stories, we take you into a deep dive conversation about spirituality and art and identity and the processes of decolonization in real time. Before we ask Ronan to start his story, let me tell you a little bit about him. Ronan O'Rahilly is an artist and researcher from County Kildare in Ireland. He received an MFA in contemporary art from the National College of Art and Design in Dublin in 2021. And has exhibited his work in solo and group exhibitions in Ireland and internationally. Working through painting and performance, Ronan's practice engages with pre-Christian Ireland as a means for contemporary post-colonial action. He visits sacred sites and researches their archaeology, history, and folklore, providing a spring for new work. Paintings are made in the studio, while performances on site are filmed or live. He is relearning the Irish language and uses it during performance for work titles and in written texts interwoven with English and his vernacular dialect. Ronan's work is a constant act of remembering and cultivating alternative ways of being in response to colonialism, Christianity, and industry. Storytelling and ritual become a practice for befriending our environment, considering identity, and encouraging healing. Well, I am so excited to welcome Ronan onto the podcast today. And as is our way on Knot Work Storytelling, we'll first ask the story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore all the ways that it resonates through our lives today. So with that, Ronan, will you tell us a story?
I want to tell you a few stories relating to my local environment, my local topography and geography. I'm from a town called Naas in County Kildare. And at the moment, I'm really interested in this intersection of real places, especially sacred sites, pre-Christian sacred sites, the folklore that's imbued in them, and also the Lug Annamnacha, which means the Irish place names. So true sites, true places, I'm learning my own folklore and my own language, a kind of a remembering process. So I'm going to take you on a tour of my local area, and we'll go through a few stories as we go. I'm going to talk about the state of the places as they are today, because unfortunately a lot of them are in kind of precarious states and are sometimes inaccessible or destroyed. And I think that's also important to remember when we go to these places, that they're not always as protected as they should be. So I'm going to start with the word Kildare, because that's one of the first things I even remember learning as a kid in school. Kildare comes from the Irish Kildare, which is Church of the Oak. So if you ever see Kil in an Irish place name, it usually means church, and Darach is the oak tree. So that's one of the first things I learned as a child. It's one of my first memories of a sense of place and a meaning and a history. Kildare town is well known for its cathedral, which St. Bridget built. Some people kind of speculate that there might have been a sanctuary for the goddess Bridget, who's a separate entity. But also just the oak tree is known for being sacred in Ireland in the pre-Christian times. So we can speculate that the Church of the Oak that St. Bridget built, there's some memory of a pre-Christian sanctuary, whether it was for the goddess Bridget or for the oak tree itself. If you go just outside Kildare town, there's a place called Allen. There's the Bog of Allen, Allen Wood. But I want to talk about the Hill of Allen. And that's kind of bringing me to my main hook for these places. It's related to Fionn MacCool. I suppose Fionn is famous throughout Ireland, but his name keeps popping up in all my local places. So I imagine that he had some sort of significance in my locality. So the Hill of Allen comes from this word Aluna or Alvin, and I can't find a translation for it. So the translation's just been lost to time, as far as I know. But it's actually one of the most referenced places in Irish mythology in the Fionn cycle, because the Hill of Allen is where Fionn had his base. It was his fortress, him and his warrior band Fianna. That was their base, and they would go hunting and training around the plains of Kildare. Kildare is mostly flat, so it's a very significant hill. It sticks out in the landscape. And like, if you're reading about Fionn and the Fianna, it's kind of common at the end of an adventure or at the end of quest or something, it'll always say, and then they return to Allen and they had a feast. And so it's kind of like this return place. So I suppose for me, it's kind of a sacred hill or a holy mountain. There's a holy well on it as well. And there's like kind of various megalithic sites. It was also dug up at one stage, and seemingly a giant's skeleton was found. Fionn MacCool is famously a giant. So the bones were reinterred somewhere secretly in the mountain. Unfortunately, the Hill of Allen is one of the worst in terms of its like current state, because it's being quarried at the moment by Roadstone Limited. They have a 50-year agreement with Kildare County Council, which started in 2008, so they have another 30 years. But if you go on Google Maps and type in Hill of Allen and go to your satellite setting, like, you can see that literally half the hill is gone. And there was a car park, there was a public route to go to the top, but that's all been blocked off. So there's nowhere to actually really safely park your car. Like, you can go there and you can climb the hill, but it's hard. So that site in particular is really stands out for me as kind of a heartbreaking site. Just the fact that as well, like I didn't mention the Kildare and Wicklow in the east side of the country, they're not well known as places with like mythological past. You know, we might think of Sligo or the Ulster cycle, you know. So it was an opportunity to have that in Kildare, but instead it's been quarried and the mythological part of it's been left behind. There's an art centre in Limerick in Askeaton town, which is run by two amazing artists, Sean Lynch and Michelle Horrigan, and they publish books, and they have a publication called The Men Who Eat Ring Forts, which I really recommend. It's about sacred sites. Well, specifically, ring forts are often destroyed by industry or building roads and that sort of thing. But they mention the Hill of Allen in it. And there's this anecdote that, like, Fionn's bones have now been removed from the mountain, ground up, and that's what our roads in Ireland are made with. So Fionn Mac Cumhain's bones have been paving our roads for the last few decades. And, you know, just this whole thing about Fionn being asleep, that he's going to wake up again. So I wonder what will happen when he does. If we move away from the Hill of Allen, we come to my hometown of Naas. And Naas was kind of an interesting one for me in terms of getting interested in the Lug Annamnacha, because when I was growing up, we were taught that Naas in Irish is Naas na Ri, which we were told means meeting place of the kings. And historically, the kings of Leinster did meet there. But there's no Irish word Naas for meeting place. There is a word Nask, N-A-S-C, which means like a connection or something like that. But it's a bit of a stretch. And I've just found out recently through Monumental Ireland, who have great posts online about Irish myth and history, that in the Din Seanchus, which is what we call it, the lore of place names, which was written in medieval Ireland, it's like a mythic telling of the geography of Ireland. It says that the god Lu had a wife. So I guess she was a goddess, and her name was Naas. And when she died, where she was buried was named after her. So Naas na Ri might actually just be Naas, the place named after the goddess of the kings, where the kings met. And yeah, I got very interested in this because it kind of hints at like forgotten histories. Naas isn't mentioned in the Book of Invasions or the Tawn or Fionn Cycle. It's kind of like this forgotten goddess. It also hints at kind of like contested histories, because a lot of people in the town weren't really willing to accept that mythological story, because they just wanted to be meeting place of the kings, and they don't want to have to change how they interpret the translation of the town. Now it's on signpost just as Am Naas, which ironically is that was the first ever mention of the place. It was just called Dún Naas, which like the fort of Naas or Naas. So it's actually gone back full circle. So that particular one got me really interested in these Lug Annamnacha and how they can teach us about history and myth and contested histories. Once you go outside Naas, you come across a place called Punchestown, just Balia Funche Asquelga, which I cannot find a translation for. So like Aluna, it's been lost to time. But Punchestown is well known for having a horse racing course. And in a farmer's field beside the race course is a 7 meter high standing stone, which I believe is the highest or the tallest standing stone in the country. It's huge. And we call it the long stone. But in kind of vernacular culture, we sometimes call it Fionn's toothpick. So Fionn Mac Cumhain, like I said, he's a giant. He was on the Hill of Allen, his fortress, after a hunt, and they were having their feast. And after the feast, he needed to pick his teeth. So he picked up this 7 meter long stone. If you ever see it, it's very sharp. So he started to pick his teeth and hurt his gum. So in a fit of rage, he threw the stone from the Hill of Allen, and it landed in Punchestown, and it's been there ever since. Just again, in terms of like the state of it today, it's on like a farmer's private land. There's no car park and there's no sign. I've never actually stood beside it. I've seen it from the side of the farm. Yeah, it's not actually accessible to the public, really. Now we're going to go further east into County Wicklow. My mom's from Naas and my dad's from Wicklow. So you go past Blessington Town, which is Bolia Comeen in Irish, which is the town of someone's surname was Comeen. You go north up through Manor Kilbride, which is Kilvreeja, so similar to Kildare, so the church of Bridget. And up to a mountain called Sí Fingan, just on the border with Dublin, just south of Tallaght. There are four peaks on this mountain, and each peak has a cairn, but one of them is well known, and we call that Sí Fin. There are a lot of Sí Fins all around the country. It's a very common name, and they all have variations of the same theme. So Sí Fin translates as the seat of Finn or the seat of Fionn. And it's kind of its own like local version of the Hill of Allen. It's the same story. It's like Fionn and the Fina have their base there and they go hunting in the surrounding valleys. And when they're finished, they go back up here and they have their feast. It's also said to be a portal to the other world. And when it was excavated, there were no findings inside it. So that might suggest that, yeah, maybe it was purpose built as a magical place rather than a like functional burial site. It's a really beautiful place, really powerful. The roof is now caved in, so there's a hole in the roof and you can get in through the hole. You're not supposed to. So it's kind of actively being destroyed all the time because even when you every time you climb up, you're kind of your feet are disturbing the stones of the cairn. And the mountain itself is amazing. There's all these beautiful streams. They're just flowing down it. It's just water. It's just coming up out of the mountain at all times. But, and it is forested. When, like, when you see it first, you think, oh, it's such a beautiful forested place. But when you look at the trees, they're all Sitka spruce, which is a non-native tree, which makes up the majority of forests in Wicklow and around the country. It's mostly used for industry, so it's good for forestry and logging. But the problem is that there aren't many native trees there. There's no variety of trees, so it kind like people call these Sitka spruce monoculture forests, ecological deserts. Animals don't go there, and the ground ends up being full of carbon. So again, it's kind of the same thing. It's like this amazing, powerful place, but there's a bit of a sadness there as well, or there's something not right. Anyway, I'm going to take you back to the N81, which is the national road from Dublin, from Tallaght down through Wicklow down to Carlow. So, as you go south from Sí Fin back through Blessington, you'll come across a village called Hollywood, which in Irish is actually Killeen Queeveen, which translates as the little church of Queeveen, who's Kevin, Saint Kevin. He's the saint who set up the monastery in Glendalough. And Hollywood is where you start a pilgrimage path called Slí Cuimhin, the Way of Kevin. So it's impossible for me to tell or to know, but sometimes I imagine that there was a pilgrimage path there in pre-Christian times, or that Glendalough was somehow used by Fili or Druids or pre-Christian spiritual practitioners. And it is a really amazing, beautiful path as well to spend time on, and feels quite reflective knowing that hundreds and thousands of people have walked along this path for centuries to go to Glendalough, which is a beautiful, rich valley. When you go past Hollywood or Killeen Queeveen, you come across a place called At Grainy, which in Irish is At Grainia, which could be possibly translated as the field of the sun. And there's a well-known stone circle there called the Pipers, the Piper Stones. And the story there is that people have heard the music of the fairies at this stone circle, where the music of the fairies can be heard here when the wind blows through them. Another story is that there were people playing music and dancing, and God, as in the Christian God, punished them for enjoying themselves on the Sabbath and turned them to stone. So that's who they are. So you can kind of see this contestation between Christianity and the pre-Christian, that the Christian has to kind of overlay itself on top of the pagan traditions. I haven't been there in a while, but lately online I've seen posts that the farmer has actually taken away access to the stones, put up a fence saying no access, and they're trying to get rid of they've taken away the public signage which gave information about the stone. So I'm not sure right now what the situation is, but it seems like there's an issue with access at the moment, which is quite sad because it's one of the most visited sites in Wicklow. There's a fairy tree there, a hawthorn tree, and every time I've gone, there's been something new left in it. So it really does feel like an active place of worship. It feels like an active church. So I'm not sure what's going to happen there. When we keep going south, we go past the town where my dad is from, which is Dunlavin. And in Irish, that's Dún Luain. A dune is a fort or a fortress, and Luain, kind of similar to the Nace story, it's Luain was some sort of queen or princess or even like a goddess or some sort of mythical person who's buried under this fortress. The story has become obscured now, but the fort is where the she or the fairies are supposed to dwell. You go up again through a village called Dunard, the high fortress, and into a valley called the Glen of Imal. Glen in Irish is a valley, and Imal comes from the name of a tribe's people who used to live there, the Imal or the Omal people. And this is where the Irish army actually have their training base. But there's also walks. There's areas that are publicly accessible for walking as well. But there's a place here called Nikin, which in Irish is Canuckin. Canuck is a hill. And when you put E in app or something, it makes it small. So a little hill. So near Nikin, near the Glen of Imal, is Lugnaquilla, which is the highest mountain in Wicklow, or the highest mountain in Ireland outside of County Kerry. So it's quite imposing. And Fionn Mac Cuil, the giant, was around this part as well, and he had sown oaths all around the surrounding area. And he was on Lugnaquilla one day admiring his oat planting and saw sheep at Canuckin eating his crops. So again, angrily, he picked up a stone, threw it from the peak of Lugnaquilla, and it landed in Nikin. And it's standing there today. So it's an Olm stone. But the story is that the Olm itself is Fionn's fingerprints from when he threw it. If anyone doesn't know about Olm, it's an old alphabet in Ireland that's based off the Latin alphabet. Was invented by the god Ogma or Oma. And every letter corresponds to a tree. So we mentioned the oak tree is Darach. So the letter D is oak, Darach. And this particular stone says M-A-Q-I-N-I-L-I, Mackie Nilly, which is MacNeil, basically the sons of Nile. So possibly some sort of territorial marker or something like that. But it's a really beautiful place. Not many people go there. It's quiet. It's quite remote. And yeah, well worth a visit. Again, like, it's an army training ground, so some parts are inaccessible. And it's also surrounded by Sitka spruce. There are some deciduous trees and native trees, but mostly Sitka spruce. So we're running into the same issue in all these different places. And the last place I want to bring you is further south again, just near the town of Baltinglass, which Osqueilge is Balach Cunglas. Balach is your way or your path. And Cunglas is, I'm not totally sure, but Cunglas might have been the name, or I've also seen it as Cúglas, but some sort of warrior who was hunting a boar in the area. So it was his way of his hunt. And while I was just Googling this morning, someone was telling me that he was a warrior of the Fianna. So possibly I'm not sure, but maybe we have more Fionn and the Fianna action around this area. But there is a hill to the east of Baltinglass. Baltinglass is surrounded by hills. It's one of the richest places in the whole country for ring forts. There's a ring fort on almost every hill. On one of the hills, there's a stone circle. This particular area is called Bowley Carrageen, which comes from the Irish Boulia on Carrageen. So Boulia, this is kind of like Mancon Magan's book, 32 words for real, for field. This is one of those words. So Boulia is a field that you bring your cows out to in the summer to graze. That's the specific meaning of that word is, so say like summer cow pasture. And Carrageen means little rock. So it's the summer pasture of the little rock. So immediately the Loganum tells you what was happening in this area. The rocks themselves, this is a stone circle. It's lined up with the winter solstice. So in the winter solstice, I can't remember if it's the morning or the evening, but the sun shines through. There's an obvious entrance up the stones. Overlooking Bowley Carrageen is Cadine Mountain, the flat-topped mountain. And when you're standing in the stone circle, looking at the mountain, whatever way the heather or the peat or the grass or the soil, whatever way it's formed, you can see a picture. If you use your imagination, you can see two people. It looks like there's two people in the mountain. So the local story is that that's Fionn and his wife, which I assume is Sive. We call the stones the griddle stones. So every morning they come down from the mountain to Bowley Carrageen and they fry their breakfast off the stones. So I always have a lot of fun imagining what they might be eating for their breakfast. Something fried anyway, if it's griddle stones. So yeah, that's one of my favorite places. And I love the Loganum and the meaning behind it and the playfulness of it. And I love how it also tells you stories that you won't read when you're reading the Tann and the Fionn Cycle. They're just local stories that have humor in them and they seem a bit more personable. Again, Bowley Carrageen, private land, no car park, no sign. There is a path, but you have to kind of find it yourself. Surrounded by sitka spruce trees, so no deciduous trees in the area, no oaks, ash, whatever. So again, this same issue in all the places. So that was the end of my tour. I thought it'd end with a nice, positive and fun place.
Oh, Ronan, thank you for this. What a fabulous blend of the raw material of myth itself and, you know, this very important commentary on the way in which we're using and misusing the land right now and everything in between. That was just, well, I want to get on a plane right now and say, okay, where are we starting? And I'll meet you in how many days will it take?
I'll give you the real tour.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for just getting us, you know, bringing us in so close and really inviting us to see, well, so much of what matters, like how we interact with these spaces today, what's possible, what we can know, what we can dream, what it inspires us to imagine, all the way to, you know, thinking about what Fionn had for breakfast. I mean, wow.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Gosh, there's so many places to go with this. And, you know, because you're part of our Myth Workers and Culture Makers series, I know that for you, it's both about being in the land and with the land and experiencing it. And it's also about what you make in terms of the art that you create based on your inspiration from these spaces. So I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit more about if any of these specific spots really have stuck with you and been with you and informed other things that you've made or imagining you might make.
Yeah, well, the reason I go to these places is for my own personal practice, but also for inspiration for my artwork.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a series of paintings at the moment. and every painting is the result of a site visit. So that's how this started. So the series is Kildare and Wicklow are the base, but there are other places like Sligo and Slieve Gullion in Northern Ireland and Loch Gur, Stone Circle in Limerick, and even Sweden and Italy and Greece were involved as well. So in terms of how they inspire me, something that I'm really interested in is visionary ritual and trance work and channeling and accessing the unconscious or the usually inaccessible parts of our consciousness. So like I first got really interested in modern art. You have surrealism where artists were trying to access their unconscious. So it's very secular. You know, they're using Freudian theories and they were using different methods, like automatic drawing. So you just let your hand wander on the page. And then if you go further into the 50s and 60s, you have abstract expressionist painting in New York where artists were using their body. And there's like a chance aspect, like Jackson Pollock in New York was the drips are there's an aspect of chance. So there's all these sorts of rituals recorded. Imbas, where you eat the meat of a specific animal and chant over a stone, and then you go into a sleep and get like a vision from the gods. There's all these sorts of things like reading the future in the flights of birds or in the rustling of leaves, or Fionn McCool sucks his thumb, and that's potentially something to do with the hand. There was some sort of ritual for this, or like using the hand or the fingers as like a memory aid. Like the recurring thing is like lying down with your eyes closed in a dark space, whether it's inside or else going out to the wilderness. And there's all just kind of these unexpected things like putting a stone on your stomach, which I still haven't figured out the reason for. But these sites became places for me to practice this visionary work at. So it started off naturally. Like I mentioned the Piper Stone Circle. That's probably the one that's the one that sticks out in my mind, because that's the one that I've been to the most. I spent the most hours at. It's my local one. And like I said to you, it's the one that people go to the most. So it really does feel active. So like when I would go there, I didn't know why I was going. I just was really attracted to these places, and you'd meet these people there that you wouldn't usually. But you know, you go there and someone would be meditating, or someone would be lying down, or yeah, it was a place for people to have their own time. So it was a natural thing for me to start doing, was to start going to these places for my own time out or meditation time. And then as I got interested in this whole thing about chance and automatism and channeling, and then I started learning about imbas, I started to be interested in the idea of channeling places. So I would perform these meditations in the places, and that's what I've been doing the last 3 years in a very formal and conscious way. So I go to the places, sit for a while, and basically just sit still and close my eyes, and whatever images come to mind. Sometimes it'd be quite intense and quite powerful and kind of surreal imagery, and sometimes it's less so. And sometimes, you know, like with the likes of Seafin, you know, the roof's caved in, and it's a really popular place for hikers, so it's not always possible to find a quiet space. So it depends on the place, but basically, like, I would allow myself to have images come to mind, and usually it's kind of dictated by the place itself and also the stories, and a lot of the places I suppose I would have a personal connection to as well. And then I would record whatever images had come to mind. Usually it lasts about 5 or 10 minutes. Record that just in my notes on my phone, and then they become the basis for a painting. Yeah, so one example was like when I went to Knocknarea in Sligo. As I was walking around, I really did have this image in my mind's eye of Queen Maeve standing within the cairn, as this ghostly figure. That's where she's meant to be buried, standing up. So that became the basis for a painting. So, but then in a place like, I suppose that's an obvious thing to see when you're there, because that is literally the story.
Mm.
But a place like the Piper Stones, because I'm there so many times, and I have a kind of like a build up of visions from that area, and that's actually also aligned with the winter solstice. So like I've often had images of some sort of dragon or some sort of elk dragon coming from the sun into the stones, and then that would become like the starting point for a painting. But I suppose, yeah, what I'm kind of conscious of and what I'm trying not to do is not to just illustrate my visions, or not just illustrate the myths, and to try and just take them as they're like, you know, the prompts, their starting points, and then the paintings become something else.
Well, and what you're naming too, I'm so sort of enraptured and fascinated by is all that's blended in from, you know, this is what we have from the passed on stories. This is my own experience of being in the place. This is where it feels as if, okay, this is perhaps my own imagination and my own personal, you know, memory bank of what I've got stored away from what I forgot that I learned when I was six. And then what it is that comes through in that sort of collective unconscious state of like, if I'm open enough, I'll receive a message that I couldn't possibly have held within my own being, but is held within that greater beyond. And, you know, that's just so close to what I'm so fascinated with, and that I know, I feel like it's my own work too, is to keep engaging with what I'm hearing you saying with the all that's possible, and really like naming it as saying it is channeling. It's not just, isn't the human mind such an amazing organ? And because I feel like, you know, we get reduced down to that as saying, well, no, just human consciousness is just very expansive. And the other side is, no, the all that is, everything you walked us through over time and space, and who knows about the great story of the sun elk that no human eyes were there to see. Like, it's just so inspiring. And it just feels like it, even as you kind of pull us into these greater, more expansive ways of knowing, it's also deeply anchoring. So thank you for it. It just feels like a gift, just being able to sort of sit in this set of possibilities and potentialities that you offer to us.
Thanks. Yeah, they do. The anchor is a nice analogy. The places really do feel like anchors and punctuations and places to take stock and take time and remember, whether it's language or story or just a connection with the natural world in a more sincere way.
You know, and that reminds me of something you had said too, where, you know, you mentioned how the Piper Stones have drawn you back personally so often, but I think you said something around how they have a special potency because they are visited by others and they're still held within the contemporary consciousness. And I know, you know, Seafin is a hiker spot, so it's not necessarily quite the same spot for a pilgrimage. So sometimes we try to get deeply meditative and then you realize there's people out with their dogs and it's kind of hard
to
be.
That's happened to me many times up there.
Right. But that sense of where you really sort of feels like you're underlining that sense of the places that we still remember collectively are still imbued with power. And perhaps it's, you know, one of the other lesser known spots that you've brought us to today, maybe back once upon a time, they were even more powerful. But what matters is how we interact now, and not just some, you know, long forgotten past of, but this was a much more exotic stone circle, or clearly the ancients spent more work on this particular passage tomb. That's just a single standing stone, but that's where people are drawn now. And there's some interesting play there.
That's really been part of my practice for the last few years. I suppose I kind of think about it as like DIY decolonization or DIY spirituality in a, but for me personally, in a post-Christian world, because I grew up Catholic and then decided that wasn't for me. But I suppose that now I'm looking back to my, like, the folklore that's in Ireland already, but not always knowing how to engage with it. And like, yeah, you can look at the Order of Bards and Druids, or, you know, there are groups that you can join, or there is communities out there. But for me personally, I think I'm more drawn to like solo work. So a lot of the time I just don't know what to do. And, you know, like I've been to Holy Wells, or I've been to Stone Circles, or I've been to Stand of Stone, and I've traveled, and then I've got there, and then I've said, right, what do I do now, or what's going to happen now? And yeah, it is really fascinating to watch how people engage with these sites today.
Yeah.
Like, I go to the Hill of Tara on the 21st of June. We've done it the last 4 years in a row now for the solstice.
Mm.
And it's amazing because it's so unorganized. Every time I've been, it's been a completely different experience. You know, there's been, and like, yeah, you have this range of people. You have people who claim that they are druids, you know, they wear the robes, and they have seen them bless the Leofall stone and place flowers on it, and they actually have ceremony. Then you have people who don't claim any group or don't claim any religion, but they're drawn to these places in general. And then I've like at the Hill of Tara, you have people who just want a party. You know, they go to the festivals every year, and this is just another festival for them. Like, there's also people who are like fire dancing there. And then the thing I love about it as well is that there's people who are locals who go there, and they just bring their dog for a walk, or they bring like a schlitter and a hurl, and they're just like pucking around the ball. So it's really this, like, it really is this, you get the sense of it, you know, the thing in ancient Ireland, like the center where people are meeting from all the distant corners in the country. And it's so fascinating to see what they actually, like, why are they being drawn there in the first place? Why do they even want to go there? And then what do they do?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think what I'm drawn to is the DIY aspect of it, like doing yoga there, or chanting, or meditation, or a druidic ritual, or just walking your dog are all valid.
Yes. That sense of, you know, in some ways we're recovering from the rituals of the church and what that did to us and our more immediate ancestors, and, you know, did too is an interesting way of putting it, but I think it both offered solace and wonder, and also a lot of being held within the strictures of somebody else's organizing way of, this is the only path to the divine. And then there's also that sense of wondering what did Imbus Ferocity really look like? What did that mean to eat the meat? And why did Patrick decide to outlaw it? What was it about it that was so frightening? And that sense of where we're always in this dance between releasing that which we know, reaching for that which we can wonder about, at desire to reclaim a something. And then also that really the urge for the free form that says, I don't know, I just know I need to go today. And whether I've, you know, whether I've got the dog on a leash, or whether I'm going to go up there with, you know, my own little, my pockets full of my sacred stones and feathers, or I don't know, I brought rain boots because I know it's going to be a mess up there. Like, it's, I find that, I mean, it's real life, as you name, and it's both so fabulous for being able to welcome it at that, like, everyday thing, that level. But I think you and I might share too, this sort of, whether we call it a craving for the numinous, or just that desire to say, oh my goodness, I'm so grateful to be just rooted into the earth beneath my feet. And that is good. And that is more than good. And also, could I have a slightly transcendent experience today? That would be really cool.
Yeah, well, I've often wanted a very transcendent experience, but
I was trying to be humble. Yes, very.
But yeah, sometimes the days where I've just went with tea and a picnic have been just as memorable.
Yeah.
And like, I live in Dublin at the moment, so I get the craving every now and then, like, I need to go to Wicklow. It's kind of a reset button, maybe.
Right. Well, since we're on the topic of ritual, and since we're just around the time of Bjaltina, I would love to just explore with you a little bit around your decision to create your own ritual around sort of rebaptizing yourself. I know that was 4 years ago on Bjaltina. I was able to watch the watch the video on YouTube. And I'd love for you just to talk a little bit about what drew you to create that ritual and how it continues to resonate for you now.
Yeah, well, it's funny that we've just mentioned the post-Christian world, or because I actually called it, it's an artwork. It was my first ever piece of performance art that's called Bealtaine Baptism. So it was using a Christian ritual as a framework to actually get myself out of Christianity in a funny way. But it was in 2021 during the COVID lockdown, and I was doing my master's at the time in a course called Art in the Contemporary World in NCAD in Dublin. So I was doing the master's remotely for the year and writing my thesis about a German performance artist called Joseph Beuys, who visited Ireland and Britain many times. He was interested in the Celtic world, and he incorporated it into his performance practice. The piece I was writing about was called 7,000 Oaks, where he planted 7,000 oak trees in the city of Kassel in Germany, and each tree had a basalt stone beside it. So it was kind of this obvious reference to what I've been talking about, you know, Kildare, Church of the Oak, but also the basalt stone of the Giant's Causeway, this volcanic stone, which is also linked to Fionn McCool, actually, because Fionn built the Giant's Causeway. Anyway, that's what I was writing about. And my whole practice, my whole research practice, my writing practice, my art practice is based on decolonization. And through speaking with my supervisor, we kind of ended up at this issue of, like, what does it mean to write a thesis employing like a decolonizing methodology if you're still going to use like standard English and the conventions of the academic, like art history, the history of art history itself, you know, to just engage with that blindly? Like, is there a way to maybe disrupt it a bit? So I had this whole thing about my voice, and over time kind of got to this conclusion that I had to have some sort of shift in my identity. And it was kind of like, this is during COVID, so I kind of decided, well, if I'm really going to be, if I really want to talk about like Irish myth and Joseph Beuys and the oak tree and really decolonize myself, I have to become a druid. That was the idea. And like, I'm not going to join the order of druids or anything like that. I'm just going to claim myself one, which is a bit cheeky, but like, my reasoning was that the druids, like, no one can really ever be a druid the way they were historically, so why can't I just proclaim myself one? It's as good a way as any. So that was the idea, but that actually turned out to be the lesser. There was this unconscious thing going on, so I decided that I had to write in phonetic or vernacular speech. So like, I'd been reading Flann O'Brien at Swim Two Birds. He actually like writes in the phonetic Irish speech. And I said, right, I'm going to write my thesis in that voice. And that became, you know, the druid's voice. So it began as this sort of alter ego. It was a way for me to be a bit more rebellious or to break the conventions. But then I said, like, my English name, Ronan O'Reilly, I said, like, I can't have this name anymore, or that can't. My name has to be in its original Irish form. That's a way to decolonize myself in a very personal way and very immediate. So there was a great artist called Brian O'Doherty from Roscommon. And during the Northern Irish Troubles, in 1972, there was Bloody Sunday in Derry when 13 civilians were shot dead by the British Army. They were peaceful protesters. So he, as a response to this, like a protest piece, he has a piece called Name Change, where he changed his name to Patrick Ireland, which was kind of very on the nose, but it was purposely on the nose. He said he wanted it to, like, take the stereotypes, you know, the Paddy. And also, like, just the word Ireland itself was kind of contentious at the time. He's like, he knew it would annoy say, the likes of the British Army. So he actually hosted a ritual and he changed his name to Patrick Ireland as a protest against occupation in Northern Ireland. Mm. And when the Good Friday Agreement was signed in the 90s, he held another ritual where he buried Patrick Ireland. He said Patrick Ireland had served its purpose. So I was really inspired by this because I, like, Brian O'Doherty's work isn't overtly about myth or ancient religions or anything, but I saw it as a sort of a shamanic or animistic rich, or just a ritual of, like, a lot of rituals we go through are for change. Yeah. And, you know, it's a common thing you might hear of, like, an animistic practitioner of, like, as a shapeshifter or taking on a different identity. So that's what gave me the confidence to say, right, I'm going to proclaim myself a druid and I'm going to change my name. So at Samhain, Halloween, I said to my parents, in 6 months' time at Bealtaine, I want you to re-baptize me. Mm-hmm. And I want you to take away my English name and I want you to give me my Irish name. And they kind of laughed about it, thought I was joking. It went on for a while, like months passed, and I said, you know, Bealtaine is coming up, so we're going to have this family ceremony, remember? And they said, are you serious about this? And I said, yeah. Like, and they were kind of resisting. Mm-hmm. And anyway, at the end, I said at dinner one night, I said, you didn't give me a choice in my baptism as a baby, so I'm not giving you a choice in this. that somehow convinced them. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know what lockdown was like for you, but for us, there was this rule of, like, I can't remember what it was. Now, you're not allowed to go 5 kilometers away from your house or something like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so it was that time. So we went on a hike to Glendalough and I had my water bottle with me. And it was like the week before Bealtaine, and I said, well, we need holy water for this ceremony. So we were walking along the river of Glendalough and I bent down and filled the water bottle. So yeah, it was all just happened naturally. And yeah, once the 1st of May actually came, yeah, I just said to my family, like, my parents were there and I also have 3 sisters and a brother. So it was 7 of us in the house. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in the morning, I just said, like, we're going to have a ceremony and I want you to act. I want you to give it the respect or the seriousness that we also gave to our confirmations and communions. Like, I want you to dress up and this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, they all went along with it pretty well. And we had a bit of fun. Like, we were playing music in the kitchen beforehand. The bothy band was playing in the kitchen and we went out to the garden and I had bought honey and whiskey and we all kind of had this kind of feast. And I told the family there, like, what the purpose of this was and that I want to change my name to Irish. And I would love if they all started to use my Irish name. Mm. And I read Amargan's song, which is the poem that the druid Amargan spoke when he stepped foot on Ireland. But every sentence is, I am something, like, I am the wind on the sea, I'm a hawk on a cliff, I'm a lake in the plain. So it really spoke to this idea of the druid or the animistic practitioner as a shapeshifter or someone whose identity is not fully fixed. So I thought it was a good poem for transformation. And it's also the only thing that I have that I think might have been a prayer for Christianity. So it's become this really important, it's been a recurring piece in my work because it's the only thing that I can find that it feels like a prayer.
Yeah.
That maybe got turned into a poem as time went on.
Right.
And then I had my Bowron drum and I played that. And then my parents both re-baptized me with this water that I'd gotten from Glendalough. They both rubbed it on my forehead and they both said, like, yeah, you're no longer Ronan O'Reilly, you're Ronan O'Rahilly from now on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much it. We all clapped and cheered and went about our day. It was all very casual, but Yeah, well, it was beautiful, and I'm grateful that they actually agreed to it. Because one thing that's happened over the last 4 years is people always ask me, like, were your parents okay with this? Like, I get the impression that a lot of people's parents might not have done it.
Mm.
And it really taught me the power of ritual, because I didn't really think about it as much as maybe I should have, because, like, to actually change your name is a huge thing. And I have never done it by deed poll, so it's not official. Mm-hmm. So it's coming back to this kind of DIY thing.
Right.
It's a pain, really, to be honest, to change your name to Irish, because, like, my argument is that it's not a name change, it's a name translation. It's the same name, just in a different language, in its original form. But the,
right.
like, according to, say, like, when you're going through the airport, your passport, mm-hmm. they want it as it is. Any change is deemed, like, they can't let you through or something. So it's not as easy. And there's no, in Ireland, which I thought was, I never knew this until I've actually gone down this rabbit hole, is that, like, there's no system in place in Ireland for the government to recognize your Irish name. Mm. They just view it as a name change. So they want you to do a deed poll. There's no system where it's like, well, if your name is Ronan O'Reilly, like, we accept Ronan O'Reilly. Because we're in Ireland and it's our official language, and the only reason your name is in English is because we were colonized in the first place. Like, there's not, it's just like, oh no, sorry, that's the wrong name. So it's been a fascinating journey.
Yeah.
And it's been funny as well, because it took a long time for me to introduce myself as Ronan mm-hmm. rather than Ronan, even though it's slight change of pronunciation, but, like, my friends from home would kind of laugh about it, or, you know, it's kind of like, oh, who do you think you are now? No one ever said that, but that's what you'd be thinking to yourself.
Yeah.
And then the thing about the Druid was really funny, because this is where I learned the power of ritual, is that, I suppose, it kind of convinced me of, you know, magic. It's not always like, doesn't always have to be potions and spells and all. It's just simply saying something can make it real. So people would start introducing to me to their friends and say, oh, my friend Ron is a Druid. You have to meet him.
Huh.
And this, it just spread like wildfire. So, like, people were coming up to me saying, oh, here, you're a Druid. And, like, what do you do? And could you marry me and my partner? Or, like, all this sort of stuff. To the point where I actually had to, a year or so ago, I had to say, like, look, I think the Druid thing has been less important as time's gone on. Mm. I've kind of let that go. Then it was really about the name change and a way to shift identity. And I don't think I would be able to make the work that I've just been talking, like, we've been talking about, you know, going to these places and doing channeling. And I think it was a psychological thing. I had to have this shift in identity to be able to make the work that I want to. So,
wow.
Yeah, four years ago this week.
Yeah. And that story just feels like it lands our conversation so beautifully. It weaves in all the pieces of thinking about, you know, that personal decision that says, I must. And then that desire to weave in your family. And oh my God, I'll post the video with our show notes, because I'm just in love with all of the O'Reillys, or the O'Reillys, depending on how they want to name themselves.
They're still O'Reilly, but
they're still O'Reillys. Yeah. But the, you know, that sense of inviting people to join you in ritual, and the honesty around, like, and it's awkward. We don't know how to do this. How do we all stand around in the garden when everyone should be, I don't know, staring at their devices like normal people during the pandemic? And then even all the way to the, as you're mentioning, the real way it's difficult to change your name, and you get, you know, you're hitting up against the system. It just sounds so much like, in the same way, like, you're off to a sacred site, and then look, there's a new fence, or look, there's a stand of Sitka spruce that are, you know, just part of the commercial logging system right smack in the middle of interrupting the sacred. So I'm just so grateful that we got to sort of explore this piece, and all the way to the sense of the fluidity of identity, even as you make that decision to take your new name and you tried on Druid for a while and met everyone's expectations of, oh, this now makes you a ceremonial magician, essentially. Yeah. And now, you know, please get out your staff and, you know, give me a little Gandalf and also be able to bless my union. And that ability to define it on your own terms, it says, no, for me, Druid is to go and sit in ceremony in my own sacred, quiet way in these different places and feed these spaces and be fed by them. I'm just, I'm so grateful for this journey and all the pieces you've taken us to visit. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Oh,
thanks very much. Thank you.
Yes, yes. And there's no time to go into it now, but I will definitely include the link to the other performance piece you did around moving the stone to the holy well, especially because it really highlights in the accompanying booklet, I guess we could call it, the way in which you're using the phonetic language and interspersing it. And it's with such, you know, and my having read that before we had this conversation, it was like, it was this sort of startling thing because I realized I was reading along and then I started hearing your voice as I was reading. Mm. And I'm like, what is happening? Was that a typo? Nope. T-H-E is spelled D-E. And then it kept going and it is so effective and really affecting. And especially as you're sort of bringing in, and again, I'll share this with the listeners, but that sense of looking to what you can restore from an ancient past, and then this modern museum system language and what they've kind of done with various Irish artifacts and more. But again, we could have a whole other conversation about that. So maybe you'll have to come back another time and we'll just do that too, if you don't mind.
Talk about the well and the stone and the phonetic writing in the future sometime. Yeah.
Oh, that would be, I mean, yes, I would love to have you back. This has been such a fabulous conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Maurice. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.